I'm John Kroll. Today, on this special recorded No Limits, we're going to look at the good, the bad, the ugly, the surprises, and the disappointments in the year in movies. Yes, this is the annual No Limits Film Show. Our guests are three old friends of the program, Matthew Socey of WFYI's own Film Sociology, Ed Johnson Ott of Nuvo, and Christopher Lloyd of the Film Yap. Because this is a recorded program, we are not able to take phone calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we do hope that you will enjoy the conversation. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. This is our annual year-end movie show. We've brought the band back together again. It is a recorded program, so we will not be able to take questions or comments by phone, by email, or through social media, but we hope you enjoy the conversation. Our guests, again, it's an annual event, are Matthew Socey of Film Sociology here on WFYI, Ed Johnson Ott of Nuvo, and Christopher Lloyd of the Film Yap. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What
good
is this, here. Like 5 years in a row
we've done this? It's like our annual residency at the Village Vanguard.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's always good. I always learn a lot from these conversations about because I don't get to see as many movies as I did in my prime, sadly. So I'm going to start just by asking overall impressions. Good year for movies, bad year for movies. I'll start with Matt.
I think we hit the time-honored tradition of when it gets to right after summer, you look at what's been out the first like 8 months, you're like, oh, Jesus. And then you get wonderfully washed over with a slew of high-quality grown-up movies in the last two. I think, like last year, the question was in August, you know, is anything better than Hell or High Water? And that's what you asked from August till the end of the year. This year for me was Dunkirk, which is the best film of the summer. You know, what is better than Dunkirk from from summer till the end of the year? So I think it was probably for the par. Once you actually looked at the list and I looked and see what didn't make my top 10.
Chris,
I would say above par. Not as good as 2015, which, as people remember, I still think is one of the great film years of all time. But definitely, and I was able to kind of find good movies all through the year. The first half of the year, generally, you know, a little weaker than the second half. But I found a number of films that came out summer were amongst my favorites, although my trend this year was I really tended to enjoy the smaller independent films, the little films that a lot of people didn't get to see, and I don't really offer any explanation or apology for that. That's just what I like this year.
Yeah, well, and should say people have really strong feelings about movies, but you are in this country allowed to like what you like, basically.
Yes.
So there ultimately probably isn't a right or a wrong here. Ed, good year, bad year?
My top two choices on my list, I would argue for how great both of those are. Everything else is good. Good.
Okay.
No more.
So it's a solid year, but not an exceptional one in your view.
Not for me, at least.
Okay, so let's get to high points of the film year. What were the biggest satisfactions for you? And I'll start with Ed this time.
Oh, how good Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 came out. Because everyone was expecting the regular kind of sequel, and it became clear within a few seconds that James Gunn had taken just as much time thinking about it when he wrote the scripts, and it doesn't do what sequels do, and it delivers, and of course it's being ignored in the critics groups because it made money.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean it didn't do what sequels do?
If whatever worked in the first film, put five times as much in the new film. Make sure everyone measure out how much screen time each character should get. If one of them got a moment in the first film, it has to be roughly the same time in the second film, like that.
Okay. So it's really just revisions on a theme, basically,
yeah.
rather than...
Okay. But Guardians was different.
I mean, Galaxy was the biggest surprise and then for satisfaction me. For you?
Yeah.
Okay. Christopher.
Biggest surprise and satisfaction was the same film for similar reasons. If Ed is Blade Runner 2049, my pick for best movie of the year. Just because I love the original so much, it was such a watershed film for me. You know, I mean, it really was one of the films that made me fall in love with movies as a kid. And I did not want a sequel. I you know, it was one of those things where I just, they're going to do is just muck it up. You know, just mm-hmm. know they're just going to, it's going to be terrible, and they're going to have all these things in there. You just don't know why they're there, and they're just making a film to make a film, making a sequel for its own sake. And then the film I got was just so unexpectedly satisfying. It worked. It was a logical extension of the story narratively, and it worked emotionally. And that's pretty rare where sequels work both story-wise and emotionally. Usually with sequels, it's like you see that they want to get the characters to certain places, and the story ends up suffering because they have to go through contretemps to get them mm-hmm. there. Prime example, Star Wars, The Last Jedi, where, won't give it anything away, obviously, because it just came out, but particularly with the Rey character and, you know, what they did with her in the first movie and that what they didn't do with her in the second movie.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that because there's been a... I've noticed that's created a fair amount of buzz, and I did have some questions planned for the Star Wars film. Matt, your biggest satisfaction, biggest surprise.
Well, if you bring up Star Wars, I have to say my spoiler joke is Jedis are made out of people. So take that for what it's worth.
Well, and I don't want to ruin it for anybody.
No, I don't either, but that's my...
You know, Darth Vader is Luke Skywalker's father.
I mean, 30 years
ago.
A
spoiler
right?
for you. Yeah.
And also to say with Ed, yeah, Guardians of the Galaxy was a sequel of character development where, you know, and there was a new character or two added, but everybody was solidly represented. Even though Blade Runner didn't make my top 10, I think it was like number 11. There was a couple of films that had good imitations of other filmmakers, but it worked out in and of itself. Denis Villeneuve, who directed Blade Runner, I think he made Ridley Scott look like Michael Bay at times, but I liked his vision of it. Lady Bird, which was written and directed by Greta Gerwig, I think does a really nice Noah Baumbach impression, but makes the story her own. So the fact that we see similar feeling stories in other films, but they're able to find a little shape of their own.
And your biggest surprise or your biggest...
Probably the biggest surprise, probably looking at my list, there's two films that I almost wanted to lump together because they're about the arts, but in different ways. One is a French documentary called Faces Places about two different visual artists going through France, photographing local people and then placing them on the sides of houses and billboards and barns. It's a beautiful road picture. The other one is a Scandinavian dark comedy called The Square, which makes fun of art galleries and, you know, piles of rubble use this art, performance art that goes way too far and shows the kind of the ridiculous business side of the art world. I think we like films about artists and the process, and both of those were lovely, lovely surprises.
Okay, and before we get into the lists, because I know that... this is a slightly different question than worst film, but biggest disappointment, the one that you had hopes for that just did not pan out this year, that you went in, like Christopher was mentioning that he was almost afraid to watch Blade Runner. Obviously, that exceeded his expectations. It can work the other way, too, that you have hopes. Christopher, what was your biggest disappointment?
I'm trying to think. I made a list of what I call the underwhelmed, which are films that generally are very well liked, particularly by, you know, other film writers or people that I know and talk to and whose opinions I respect, that I was just like, huh?
Yeah.
Probably I would say the biggest disappointment in terms of the expectations that were built for me versus my own experience with the film was probably Get Out, a film that is on a lot of people's best of lists, winning a lot of critic groups' best film awards right now. So, you know, probably going to be contending for best picture at the Oscars. And I like the movie. I think it's well done. I think it's a well done horror with a little with social commentary. I don't think it goes much beyond that. People are saying it's like it's the movie for our times. I don't think so. It's just it's well done. It's funny. It's goofy. And it's got something to say. And those are all good things. But best film of the year? No.
Okay. Ed, how about you? Biggest disappointment?
Oh, gee. Blade Runner.
Okay. Am I going to have to separate you two?
No, we've already had this discussion. You're a brother.
All right. Why was it such a disappointment to you?
I wanted to spend more time in that town. I wanted to spend more time on the streets with the big lady on the wall doing all of that in the rain. And it was stylish. It had personality. I didn't want to be in the clouds with the other characters or watching yet another character contemplate something, maybe. You know, that wasn't entertaining to me. I respected the film. I think toward the bottom of my top 20, but no more than that.
Okay.
I respect it, though.
All right. Matt.
I'm torn between either The Circle, which is Tom Hanks is not Steve Jobs, and Emma Watson, who is not working for Apple or Google, and works for the Orwellian company where your phone does everything for you, and nobody sees it coming that it's going to be used for bad, not for good. The other one was Woody Allen's new film. I'm a white male, so therefore I must like Woody Allen, but his film Wonder Wheel, which when you say in the opening scenes that your narrator loves the melodramatic, you don't need to tell me how the style of the film is going to be. Woody Allen's done Dark Material before, and he sets it in 50s Coney Island. Kate Winslet's quite good, but I think he's gone down the path of Eugene O'Neill and Tennessee Williams before. And it also gets a little too autobiographical when your Justin Timberlake character is having an affair with a woman and he likes the woman's stepdaughter. They didn't quite show that in the not since Husbands and Wives. It went, really, you going there? It was a little icky.
Okay.
I should also mention a big disappointment for me was another film that's getting a lot of laudatory praise is Call Me By Your Name, which...
You wanted it shorter.
That was my... If I had a single complaint about this year's films, particularly the ones that disappointed me, it would be that they're too long. I saw so many films like Call Me By the Name. I think it's about 2 hours 15, 2 hours 20, and the first hour you could literally condense down to about 10 to 12 minutes and it would work so much better. It's literally, you know, an hour of these two characters pretending not to be attracted to each other and sort of fighting their feelings and can they admit it, and just too much screen time. Another one, Blade of the Immortal, film that I know a couple people that I really respect love that film. You know, 2:23, I think, was something that saw so many films that were, you know, well over 2 hours that could have been great at about 89 minutes.
But you didn't mind the length of Blade Runner?
No, not at all.
Hypnotic?
I mean, it was definitely a deliberately paced film, but if you go back and watch the original, there's very little action in the first film. Mm-hmm. And there's really not that much action in this one. It's more about the encounters and the just the experience of the characters and what they're going through.
Okay. So we'd be remiss, and we've got just a couple of minutes here before we have to go to the first break. Star Wars, obviously, has provoked kind of an anomaly. The critics actually seem to like it better than the fan base does, which with a big popcorn movie is somewhat unusual. Why is that, Matt?
I've been saying this about the Star Wars films and to a certain degree the superhero films. I mean, I was 7 when Star Wars came out in 1977.
Now you're just rubbing it in.
But it's hard to recreate that. It really is. And you know, I remember getting ready to sit down and watch it in the movie theater a couple weeks ago and thought, gosh, another one of these? And once I get into it, I like it. But I'm not bowled over by it. I'm not 7 anymore. And I know people that are kind of pick and choose as far as, you know, how the universe is told. And yes, there's parallels to The Empire Strikes Back. You have the training stuff and the dark stuff and the sneaking around stuff.
And I mean, some almost shot-by-shot recreations.
Kind of. But there's been the trend of giving us something old and something new. Star Wars has done that. Star Trek has done that. Bond films did that. Mad Max Fury Road did that. So I'm fine. I think maybe because I have a wife and a daughter and I don't spend much time in the basement that I don't have to get worked up about it as much.
Chris?
My main problem, I've liked all the Star Wars movies. I like the prequels that are so much mine. I will take Jar Jar Binks, no problem.
Good.
My biggest problem with The Last Jedi is it's the sort of film that, you know, other people made the first film, and then, you know, it's like, okay, and we're going to intentionally, our idea was to have the same people make the second film, but then things got changed around, and now we've got all different people, and they decided, well, we don't like a lot of that stuff from the first film, so we're going to do our own thing. And the problem is you've set up so many things and introduced expectations that then are not carried through on in the second film. You know, things that literally just, you know, like, oh, that thing that we were massively teasing and building up the first one, it, you know, there's literally a never mind moment in the sequel.
We are talking about movies here on No Limits. My guests are Matthew Soucy of WFYI's own Film Sociology, Ed Johnson Ott of Nuvo, and Christopher Lloyd of the Film Yap. This is a recorded program, so we're not able to take calls, emails, or messages via social media. But we hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're doing our annual film show here on No Limits today. It's a recorded program, so we're not taking calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you are enjoying the conversation. My guests are old friends of the program, Matthew Soucy of WFYI's own Film Sociology and Blues House Party, among others, Ed Johnson Ott of Nuvo, and Christopher Lloyd of the Film Yap. Well, we sort of talked about the Star Wars thing, biggest surprises, biggest disappointments of the year. Let's get to the meat of this thing and talk about first the good. What were the best films of 2017? And then, yes, we will deal with the ugly after that. What were the worst? I'll start with Ed on that one. Best film of 2017.
Faces, Places. Okay. No punctuation. Faces, Places.
And that's the documentary Matt was talking about earlier. What did you like about it so much?
I like being able to take a vacation to France. I like being in the country. I like those two characters, virtually everyone they met, and I love the artwork. It was a treat. I watched it 6 times.
Wow.
I know. 6 times? Well, wow.
Yeah. It's a pleasure, and it helps me calm down.
Therapy.
If I may add, I mean, it does tell you that every person has their own path, their own journey. Every person could be a subject or could be a piece of art.
Yeah.
And I think we forget that sometimes.
Yeah, it illustrates it so nicely.
It does.
The famous Hemingway quote that every person has at least a novel in them.
Yep.
You know, that there is a story to be told there. Mm-hmm. Christopher, how about you?
I'll run down my top 10 list for you. We've already said Blade Runner 2049, and 2 through 10 was Lady Bird, little film that not many people saw called Brigsby Bear, The Shape of Water, just out, Maudie, another film with Sally Hawkins, The Florida Project, Patty Cakes, another little film not too many people saw, Wind River, Baby Driver, and The Post. And I really struggled with the number 10 spot, but ended up deciding that I had to have The Post on there.
Why was that a struggle for you?
Just because I had a couple other films that I really wanted to include. Dunkirk was in the running. Another film, little film called A Ghost Story, was in the running. But in the end, I just decided The Post had more things to say about then and about our times now, particularly, you know, journalism and truth and power and all that sort of stuff.
Okay. Well, and I'll tell you what, we'll go with through our top 10 real quickly. Matt,
okay.
How about you?
Number 10 is A Ghost Story. It's a ghost story, but not a horror story.
Okay.
It's what happens when you're stuck in a spot. Number 9, Last Flag Flying, Richard Linklater's version of The Last Detail with Bryan Cranston, Lawrence Fishburne, and Steve Carell. Number 8 is Get Out. And Golden Globes. It's a documentary, not a comedy. Number 7 is The Florida Project, which we had already talked about. Life and the people who live in the motel outside the outskirts of Disneyland. Number 6, The Square, which I talked about, the arts parody. Faces, Places is number 5. Number 4 is Dunkirk. Number 3 is Lucky, with a great final performance from the late, great Harry Dean Stanton. Great film about aging. Number 2 two is Lady Bird, Greta Gerwig's film that's not about her. And my number one film is operatic in its storytelling, but rooted in, I think, the best ensemble of actors this year, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Frances McDormand.
Minnesota, isn't it?
Missouri.
Oh, it is? I thought it was... it is Missouri? Okay.
Yep. No, if it were to Coens, it would
okay,
be...
Okay, awesome. Minnesota. Okay.
But, great performance by Frances McDormand and Sam Rockwell. Also, you got Woody Harrelson, John Hawkes, just
Peter Dinklage.
Just a solid, solid cast.
Okay. Ed, how about you to complete the... who are the other players on
it's
your
a lot of familiar names here. Faces, Places, Lady Bird, my number two was Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, which I don't think that happened with many critics. I'm real happy with it. Blade Runner, Dunkirk, The Florida Project, Guardians, Get Out, The Post, and then the rest. And all of those except the top two could have changed. They've changed it numerous times, mm-hmm. you know.
So, basically... it sounds like for all of you, the top two in Ed's case, but several. And then there were a lot of others. The choices got tougher after that.
Yeah, I mean, the Indiana Film Journalists Association, of which we are a part of, we named Lady Bird Best Picture. And that was, I guess, you know, that was probably the most consensus of amongst the 14 of us.
Yeah, it was a film that I think not too many people had as their number one, but almost everyone had it as number two or number three. So when you're doing the voting and, you know, balancing the points and all that stuff, that works out. It was a very strong. In fact, it won not only Best Picture, it also won Best Director and Best Original Screenplay for Greta Gerwig, Best Actress for Saoirse Ronan, and Best Supporting Actress for Laurie Metcalf for five awards, which is a record for the Indiana Film Critics Group to give out that many
How
awards.
How many people are in the Indiana Film Critics Group?
So if I've got it right, I think it's 15, but 15. We've actually added a new member. He did not participate in this year's voting because he was just added. So I think that brings us to 16.
Okay. Wow.
Okay.
So yeah, I would take, I've written about this, I would take Lady Bird and Edge of 17 when it comes to showing a slice of teen angst over the entire John Hughes filmography. Mm-hmm. Just like I would take Lucky, which was directed by classic that guy, John Carroll Lynch.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I would take that and The Trip to Bountiful over all of the feisty old people movies post Grumpy Old Men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody, Harry Dean Stanton's not wearing sunglasses and walking in slow motion to rock music behind him. It's about dealing with your mortality. And, you know, Stanton was 91 when he made the film.
Yeah. So in some ways, as usual with these things, it's easy to talk about the best stuff, but the juices really start to flow when you talk about the worst ones. The conversation gets more entertaining when we talk about the bad than we do the good. What were the worst films of 2017? I'll start with Christopher on that.
It's always tough for me to identify the worst because usually you forget them. And I tend not to dwell on them. You see them and you're like, ugh. And then, you know, 6 months later, you have to be reminded that the film exists. And also, a lot of the really, really bad films, they just don't show to us.
Mm-hmm.
So we had another 50 Shades sequel this year.
Yeah, we did.
And that was pretty horrible. One 50 film.
50 Shades Duller.
50 Shades Duller.
50 Shades Dumber.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
One that's actually coming out the day after this broadcast airs, which probably would be my another contender for most disappointing of the film of the year, was a film that I think a lot of people expected to vie for awards, and it's actually rather bad, is Downsizing, starring Matt Damon, which, again, I don't want to give it away too much since it's just now coming out, but it's a film that's supposed to be, you've seen it, it's about the world where people decide to start shrinking themselves. So it's a lot of commentary and satire about, like, consumerism and environmentalism and how much people do environmentalism because they actually care about the world and how much do they just care about looking cool. And it starts out with this just an amazing premise and then just flushes itself down the toilet completely. And I don't want to say that the movie takes a turn that is just disastrous.
But see, I actually liked it because I knew you watched the trailer. Like you can only you know wrench out so much humor out of the small jokes, and the fact that it does take a different path. And to use the cliche voiceover guy, things are not as they seem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I didn't mind the journey that film takes. It's not Alexander Payne's best work, but I liked it. So there.
All right. So how about you, Matt? Worst of the year. Worst movies.
I feel there as a critic sometimes, because if I have a choice between seeing a big budget ridiculous film or something small that will interest me as a film show host, I'll tend to go to what interests me. So then I'll miss it, and then I'll see something on video, and like a dummy, I will rent it and go, well, how bad could this be? And I did that with The Mummy. I rented The Mummy. I didn't see it. It was a Tom Cruise running scared film, and it was more of an action film than a horror film.
Yeah.
No thrills. Didn't care about the action. Not really a spoiler, but you had Russell Crowe as Dr. Jekyll. You could have really run with that, and they didn't. I hope there was more footage of him chewing up scenery. That would have been more fun. But I think this might have single-handedly killed an offshoot of Universal trying to revamp
their Dark Universe. They were trying to resurrect their classic movie monsters, and they've kind of put the whole... I mean, supposed to be one of these big multiverses with mini movies, solo movies, and then they come together for group movies. And it looks like it's dead now.
Because Van Helsing wasn't enough a decade or so ago. I couldn't believe I actually rented this.
Yeah. Ed, how about you? Worst?
Two films involving makeovers. XXX, The Return of Xander Cage. Here's the deal.
I'm not sure you can improve in the criticism on the inflection you just gave that. But please continue.
Vin Diesel, of course, is a multi-millionaire for the Fast and the Furious franchise. He started off making XXX, The Return of Xander, and somewhere along the line, he was blinded by a green color from above, which turned out to be dollar signs, that he wasn't going to make as much up with this movie, but if there was another Fast and the Furious, well. And so he... spent while they were filming the movie, he worked frantically with his writers to Fast and Furious it up, and that's by the time he's finished, he's got another Fast and Furious movie that just waiting for some new stars.
Mm-hmm.
That's annoying. And speaking of annoying, The Disaster Artist.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Ed Wood, the legendarily bad director, mm-hmm. and.
Plan 9 from Outer Space?
Plan 9 from Outer Space. And then Timothy Burton did one of his best films, was his loving biography of Ed Wood.
Mm-hmm.
And The Disaster Artist represents the same mentality, only on purpose. It's a guy who probably is as eccentric and as untalented as Ed Wood. But he's surrounded by people that want to make movies and build the cult, and it didn't work for me. I know some people love this movie and they love the bio of the movie. I don't think this deserved to be a movie.
Hmm. You look like you beg to differ.
Well, full disclosure, The Disaster Artist is about the film, the making of the film The Room, which starred, directed, written, and produced by Tommy Wiseau, who I interviewed for the film show, and I play at least twice a year when a theater in Indianapolis shows The Room at midnight.
Yeah.
I didn't love it. I enjoyed it, but like Ed said, it has parallels to Ed Wood as far as a passionate artist who is technically inept.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably where the similarities kind of end. There's the film covers the bromance between Wiseau, who's this mysterious character, doesn't want anybody to know anything about him, and a slightly less competent actor who winds up being one of the leads in the film. That was interesting a little bit, but it does showcase Wiseau is not a very good director, not a very good person. But to be fair, I don't think Ed Wood was anybody you wanted to timeshare a condo with either.
No.
And if there was 24-hour news and social media in the 50s, think about the stuff that they could have done on Ed.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I actually liked it.
If you're just joining us, we're doing our annual film show. We're talking about movies today on No Limits. This is a recorded program, so we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media. But we do hope you're following and enjoying the discussion. So we've been talking about bests and worsts here. I want to talk about few trends. I noticed, with the exception of Ed, I think, there wasn't a superhero picture on anyone's list.
I also had Logan.
Logan?
There's a lot of argument to be made on whether that's really superhero.
Yeah. Well, advance what the argument is, whether it's a superhero film or not.
It's a dark, violent, disturbing look at mortality.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. I think many people, I know I wasn't the first one to call it. It's like the Unforgiven of superhero movies.
Yeah.
I think it's a nice swan song for Hugh Jackman playing that role. I know Fox is going to revamp it with somebody younger and do mm-hmm. some form of origin story. But yeah, it is. I think we gave it best adapted screenplay.
Yeah,
for Logan. But it
for the IFJA.
Yeah,
awards.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is dark. It is violent. Mm-hmm. It is not for kids. So you know, parents. There's a rating system for a reason. But it's actually one of my favorites. And Wonder Woman was a film that was probably my number two film of the summer. Really, mm-hmm. really enjoyable. Just not enough to crack the top 10, but still enjoyable nonetheless.
Yeah, I always make a list of, not beyond the top 10, the also-rans, mm-hmm. films that I made when I said, here's the best movies of the year.
Honorable mentions, basically.
Right, honorable mentions. Wonder Woman's on that. I thought that was the best superhero film of the year.
Yeah, and again, Guardians of the Galaxy, which I know, Ed is champion. It was a lot of fun.
It was good.
Yeah.
Well, and the big ones, though, obviously.
DC, they don't make very good superhero movies.
All right. I was going to tee it up for you, but you swung before I even let go of the ball. So that's okay, Ed. So talk to me about Justice League. Why? Because it's not showing up on anybody's list.
Zack Snyder.
Zack Snyder, director. And Matt will come up with 150 examples of why he should not get a prize from anyone. But who cares about The Flash or Cyborg or
Aquaman?
Aquaman got kind of interesting.
I mean, okay.
It was so excessive. It was like mm-hmm. he was a walking example of what a good art director could do at a gay ice capade.
Yeah.
You know,
not on the poster campaign. That's
not on the poster campaign. But it just...
I thought it was decent. I thought it was the best of the DC Comics superhero movies so far. Just because they've been building up, putting these characters together. I still really like Ben Affleck as the as Batman. A lot of fun. Of course, Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman. Then mm-hmm. you kind of had the throw-in characters, Cyborg. And Aquaman didn't do much for me. Other than, about the sixth iteration now I've seen where they took a blonde superhero from the comics and made him into a brunette, a pet peeve of mine.
Probably should point out that Christopher is noticeably blonde.
Yes. So Chris Evans responsible for not one but two characters all on his own.
And they're all played by Paul Bettany.
Yes. But it was a fun movie and I enjoyed it. Well, certainly would not make any list of the best superhero movies.
And the three most prominent members of the Justice League are icons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Superman's never been interesting. It's been what's going on around him. You know, the same with Batman. And there's a lot of around him there, but still. You know, Wonder Woman has had the same problem in comics, but she's got a fiercely loyal fan base. I mean, mm-hmm. a huge one that they didn't find out about till they made the movie.
Mm-hmm. Are we seeing the end of at least kind of a cycle of these films? Because
no.
They don't seem to be getting, well, quite the buzz, though, that they did. You know, nothing has sort of topped the anticipation of the first Avengers movie or anything like that. Chris,
I think we're moving into the next phase. You know, we've sort of had the adolescence over the last 20 years or so of the superhero film genre. And so, you know, now they're doing different things. The big thing that we've seen over the last 5 years is the movement into comedy. You know, where we had films that were, like, the first Guardians of the Galaxy was the first straight-up comedy superhero film. Mm-hmm. And we've seen more of those now with Deadpool. Deadpool mm-hmm. kind of even took it mm-hmm. a little bit further than that. And now we're seeing that where comedy is kind of baked into the grain of all the superhero movies. To its detriment at some point. Like, that would be one of my complaints about Justice League is, you know, them trying to insert little moments of hero right in the middle of a big action spectacle or preceding a big or after a big grim moment, and that often doesn't work.
You mean like the action films in the 80s.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they add a little bit in with Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yeah, we'll have to pick this up on the other side. We're talking about movies here on No Limits. My guests are Matthew Soucy, Ed Johnson Ott, and Christopher Lloyd of the Film Yap. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're doing our annual holiday film show today on No Limits. It's a pre-recorded show. That means that we're not taking calls or emails or handling questions or comments via social media. We do hope, though, that you're enjoying the conversation. My guests are three veterans of the program, Ed Johnson Ott of Nuvo, Christopher Lloyd of the Film Yap, and Matthew Soucy of WFYI's own Film Sociology and Blues House Party. So we've talked about the good and the bad and, to some degree, the ugly. Big surprises, big disappointments. Let's drill down and talk a little bit about individual performances, the ones, and I'm always interested when we see sort of new stars emerge, if there were any breakout performances this year. People who just exploded that we know we're going to see a lot more from. I'll start with Matt on that one.
Well, I'm gonna twist your question a little bit. And there's somebody who we named as runner-up for Best Supporting Actor who's been around for a while, but I think he is going to be getting the Andy Serkis treatment as far as being known for his work. It's actor Doug Jones, Ball State graduate and, full disclosure, film sociology guest. He was the fish man, basically.
And not the new senator.
It was a good week for Doug Jones that week.
Yeah.
But he was the fish creature in Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water. My favorite love story of the year. If you were to take Splash, The Iron Giant, and Beauty of the Beast and filter it through the wonderfully warped mind of Guillermo del Toro, the man who gave us Pan's Labyrinth, Hellboy, Crimson Peak, and gave us an R-rated love story between a woman and a fish character. Doug's been in everything going back to Hocus Pocus, Batman Returns. He's one of the Guillermo del Toro players, and the fact that he's getting recognition just like Serkis did a few years ago for the Planet of the Apes franchise. So I'm hoping more people get to notice him. I hope Doug gets to be a human being in a film sometime fairly soon.
He's been here a lot. Yeah. And a lot of people know him, and he would have won him over with his work anyway. But charming man.
Yes.
Ed, how about you? Biggest breakout, you think, this year, the one who exploded?
There's about six or seven little girls who all have promising careers ahead of them. The others, I mean, this is nobody, no newcomer. Sam Shepard, who am I thinking of? The Hero.
Sam Elliott in The Hero.
Elliott. And he needs to be listed because he got a whole movie about him to himself, you know. But aside from what you're really looking for, it's lots of kids, really talented kids.
Mm-hmm. Sam Elliott, that film, I remember there was a little bit of buzz about it, but it seemed to open and close at virtually the same moment.
Yeah.
It didn't jump out and grab you the way you'd think.
It's another movie about mortality, right?
Yeah, mortality and melancholy.
Yeah. It's a nice picture, and hopefully gets a bigger life on video, because you surrounded him with a bunch of good people, including Catherine Ross and Nick Offerman.
Who's his wife.
His wife in real life. And, it's just a nice, low-key picture about people that should be checked out.
And the little girl in Logan.
Yeah.
She was something. She's got a big career ahead of her.
Yeah. Chris, who do you see as the breakouts?
Lots I could point to. I mean, I could literally sit here and do a list of probably 20, but I'll throw out three that, not necessarily new names, but seeing them do things I didn't expect from them. There was Laurie Metcalf from playing the mother in Lady Bird, because, I mean, I pretty much know her from her TV work. And here was
it's
her
Roseanne's
playing
this, sister and
yeah, Sheldon's mother.
And here she was playing this very dark character, this mother who, you know, we think has a nurturing side buried very, very deep in there, and yet her instincts just keep seeming to go to the critical, yet she shows us the love that's underneath all of that. Then we've got a young actress, Danielle McDonald. She started in Patty Cakes, playing this sort of very brash yet self-doubting sort of white trash character who wants to be a rapper, and literally no one supports her, and yet she perseveres.
I'm sorry, it should be noted, it's supposed to be set in New Jersey, and the actress is Australian.
Yes, which is another impressive. And here's one that was really out of left field for me that I was not expecting, was Ray Romano in The Big Sick. He plays the husband of Holly Hunter, who's really good in it also. But, you know, we've seen her do that before. And here he was playing a somewhat comedic but still very serious role as the dad in that. And he blew me away. I was like, if you had asked me, could Ray Romano touch my heart like that, I would have said never, and yet he did.
And I should point out the IFJA for our breakout of the year went to actor Timothy Chalamet, who was in Call Me By Your Name, the son who has he has feelings for a grad student played by Armie Hammer, and he was also one of the boys of Saoirse Ronan's affection in Lady Bird.
And he was also in Hostiles, which I bring up to cheese off our friend Nick Rogers of the IFJA, who hated the film.
A very grim Western from Scott
which,
Cooper.
Which, yes, hasn't even been released yet, and I'm not sure if it will get a wide release.
Yeah.
And another mention for Laurie Metcalf on television, the show Horace and Pete, Louis C.K.'s show. Forget the controversy. I'm just talking about her. She did a 14-minute monologue with no cuts, and it was magnificent. She took you to all sorts of places, and you believed the ships. You believed everything.
It's that Steppenwolf training.
Yeah. So... you know, not long after we conclude this, the whole Oscar prediction industry kicks it into high gear. We'll get a jump on that. What do you see as the obvious Oscar nominees? I know that that's a slightly different thing than saying what the best pictures are, because you have to project what other people are going to think.
Ten to be nominated for Best Picture, and I will be offended if they are not.
Well, but you don't get to vote in the Academy,
no, I do not.
Right? Yeah.
There's a certain pedigree of film that you can just sort of look at and say, that's a Best Picture nominee for the Oscars.
Well, like The Post is obvious.
The Post,
Oscar.
Darkest Hour with Gary Oldman. They love historical dramas, love period pictures, big performances. I think you'll definitely see Shape of Water in there. You'll definitely see Get Out. You'll definitely see Lady Bird amongst the Best Picture nominees. And after that, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see if we get something like Wonder Woman to sneak in there.
Dunkirk.
I think Dunkirk definitely will get nominated.
What about the War for the Planet of the Apes?
I mean, for Best Picture?
This is their last chance to celebrate it for anything.
No.
If they stick to the trio. You
know, no, they're going to do it.
No, because it was the third film, and unlike, say, like The Return of the King with the Lord of the Rings series, it didn't do as well financially as the previous two films.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't think that'll get much attention, at least not the attention it deserves.
And my number one film was Three Billboards, and I really hope that gets a lot of
I would say that's a pretty, because we can do up to 10 now for Best Picture. So I would say all of those mentioned are safe bets.
How about Best Actor? I'll start with that on that one.
I had not given a thought to actors or any of that part. I was just working on this, but let me think here. Well, actually, one of you skipped.
All right, I'll move it over to Matt.
I'd love Harry Dean Stanton to get it. I mean, it would be if he were to get it, it would be the first posthumous one since Peter Finch in Network, and that's 40 years.
I think he'll get nominated. James Franco, I think, is a lot. Gary Oldman is a lot to get nominated. Maybe Timothy Chalamet, as you know, sort of the young up and comer, he might get a nomination. Tom Hanks might for The Post.
Yeah, that's.
Beyond that, it'll be interesting to see, because like Dunkirk, there's not really a lead role in that. Mm-hmm. So maybe we'll see something kind of come out of from left field, Jake Gyllenhaal from Stronger, film that really, really came and went very quickly. Not many people saw it. Terrific, terrific film. Out on video this week. So go check that out, because Jake Gyllenhaal is amazing in that.
It talks about how we hear how heroes are supposed to be human beings, and, and this one stresses this is a flawed human being.
Yeah,
and a really strong performance from Gyllenhaal.
I would donate the award to Kevin Spacey, and then every time he tried to get on the stage to get it, boot him in the butt, make him start all over again.
Was the Onion article where everybody, about 80 people in Hollywood, were replaced by Christopher Plummer.
He's had quite a late career renaissance here. Just
let me mention also a little film nobody saw. I love it, called Crown Heights, also out on video. Starring a young actor by the name of Lakeith Stanfield. You've probably seen him in films here and there. He's amazing. For me, that was my favorite performance of the year, along with perhaps Sally Hawkins in Maudie. Those would be my two favorites of the year. So I go hope people. I love to point people to smaller films that are terrific. Mm-hmm. So go check out Stronger. Go check out Crown Heights. Go check out Maudie.
And check out The Lost City of Z. Okay.
Yeah, I know a lot of people are very enthusiastic about that one.
If you like imitations of Goodfellas, there's I, Tonya with Alice with a.
Margot Robbie.
Margot Robbie is Tonya Harding.
It comes out January 5th.
And Molly's Game, Aaron Sorkin's directorial debut, who he also wrote it with a strong performance from Jessica Chastain. But the wall-to-wall narration and movement and style that Goodfellas did over 25 years ago.
So let's talk about best actress now.
Jessica Chastain. I think Meryl Streep, who is the best thing about The Post. I think certainly Saoirse Ronan.
I wonder if the Academy gives it the Streep just to put a bug in somebody's bonnet.
What do you mean by that?
The guy in Washington who called her overrated, even though she has 3 awards and 20-some nominations. It's a possibility.
Yeah.
But
Sally Hawkins, although she'll get nominated for The Shape of Water instead of Maudie.
She had a great year. And, yeah, Saoirse Ronan was excellent. Jessica Chastain was excellent.
Saoirse Ronan?
Anyway.
Okay. Dad, how about you, best actress?
I'd love to see Laurie Metcalf in there. I think she's earned it.
Yeah, I think she'll get nominated, but probably for supporting actress.
Yeah.
You could quibble about that one. We had a lot of discussions in the IFJA during our award cycle was about who belongs in what categories, like Michael Shannon in The Shape of Water. Is he a supporting or a lead? Mm-hmm. Sam Rockwell in 3 Billboards. Is he a supporting or the lead? You could probably make an argument for Laurie Metcalf as a lead in Lady Bird.
What's the most overlooked film of this year? The one that, and I know you're the little film guy here, so I'll start with you, Christopher.
Crown Heights, I'll mention. Stronger. I don't think too many people saw A Ghost Story.
Yep.
There's a film about Scottish golf called Tommy's Honor no one saw. Another one, historical drama called The Promise about the genocide in Turkey. Paris Can Wait, the directorial debut of Eleanor Coppola, waited until she was almost 80 years old to direct her first feature film. I mentioned Crown Heights. And another one, Goodbye Christopher Robin, about the creation of, you know, Winnie the Pooh and all that. Just a very, very touching film. And here's one that I don't think it's even been released yet. A Western called The Ballad of Lefty Brown, starring Bill Pullman, where he plays sort of, you know how in a lot of classic Westerns you had the character of the incompetent old coot?
Walter Brennan.
Yeah, usually played by Walter Brennan.
Or Jack Elam.
Or Andy Devine.
Yeah. So this is the movie where basically the John Wayne character gets killed off pretty early and the incompetent old coot character takes over the movie. And I really, really admired that.
I would say Faces Places because that should be seen by everybody. And then my other favorite romantic comedy of the year that came out in the first half of the year is called The Lovers with strong performances from Deborah Winger and Terry Letts, who was in The Post.
Yeah.
Tracy Letts.
He had a really good year.
Was the dad in Lady Bird. And it's a longtime married couple, and they have lovers, but son's coming home from school, and they keep promising their lovers they're going to break it off, and they don't. Well, go rent it. But it's a lot of fun, and it's good seeing Deborah Winger again. But, yeah, that's a fun pair.
How about you, Ed? Most overlooked?
I know no chance for best actress, but that little girl from Logan, what's her name?
I can't remember.
I can't remember the actress's name, but she was exceptional.
Yeah.
And actually, if I made such lists, I don't see as many movies as you guys do. I actually really enjoyed Logan, and I thought it was an interesting kind of updating of the classic Western to a lot of those themes. So what are we looking at ahead here? It is Daphne Keene.
Apparently thank you.
Is her name.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Oh,
yeah, so what are we looking at in for 2018? What films are you most excited about, and which films are you most dreading?
Well, Chris, I did some research before the show, and unfortunately, when you're, you know, trying to look 6 months, 8 months, 12 months ahead, you know, the only things that are really like set in stone for their release dates are the big tentpole movies.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's hard to know like what's going to be the three billboards outside Ebbing of 2018, just because that film's, you know, doesn't even have a release date set. So the list I've got is pretty much all superhero and or sequel films. Avengers Infinity War. I've enjoyed all the Avengers films. The Deadpool sequel. That should be fun. One I'm personally really looking forward to is they're making a sequel to Wreck-It Ralph. That sounds like it would be fun. Another Jurassic World movie.
She'll wear flats this time.
Yeah, another. They're doing another Ant-Man and Wasp are teaming up for a movie. They're doing another X-Men movie. Okay, I mean, I'll look forward to those. The one Pixar Disney animated film that people have been saying for years they should make a sequel of, they finally have, The Incredibles. So there we've got, it's a sequel, it's animated, and it's a superhero picture. Film that I'm personally looking forward to is the next Steven Spielberg movie. It is an original film called Ready Player One. Great book that I just read, a friend recommended to me, about a dystopian future in which basically people live entirely through video games or a digital world. And you have this sort of, you know, kid who comes from nowhere to become the hero of that world. I'll be interested just to see how they managed to get all of the property rights to all the different intellectual material that's in the book, or if they just didn't.
I'm terrible about doing previews, John. I have full disclosure. Yeah. I'm just looking for the next good film. And once we get through award season, you know, January, February, March is kind of, yeah. So, you know, because usually films that are on the shelf or the films that just kind of get kicked out there so something can be in the multiplexes. So that's really when I start to hopefully dig and be an explorer and hopefully find the next cool small little picture.
And the list we're looking at, if you think about it, Blade Runner and The War of the Planet of the Apes are most likely the only two films on this list we would have picked, we might have picked a year ago.
As movies you are excited to see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Other than that, you know, the best ones on here are all brand new titles for us.
We've got just about a minute here real quickly, but we talk about Christopher was talking about the dystopian theme, why that is so prevalent in so many of our movies.
1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Well, but it predates that, though.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, these films are coming out now or conceived 5 years ago.
It's just not for young. It's not for books based on for young audiences anymore.
I guess just because when people look to the future, it's kind of silly and self-serving to say, and everything's going to be great. Well, why would you make a movie about if everything's going to be great 5 or 10 or 50 years from now? To make it interesting, you kind of have to look at the dark patches and the pitfalls and see how we fall into those or how we try to avoid them.
And dark and disastrous means cheap. You know, no.
You don't have to pay for lighting.
No.
In space, no one can hear you eat avocado toast.
Oh, and
I guess we'll make that the last word here, guys. Thank you very much, as usual. I'd like to thank my guests, Matthew Socia of Film Sociology, Ed Johnson-Ott of Nouveau, and Christopher Lloyd of The Film Yap for what has been a fascinating conversation. This is our last show of 2017. You're going to be able to hear some good music at this time on Thursday, but we hope everyone has a very pleasant new year, and we will see you again in 2018. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.